Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. In the first part of the show, we speak to author, activist, feminist, and Ryerson University professor Judy Rebick about International Women's Day. She speaks about the historic victories of women and the current reality for women today with a vision for the future. In the second part of the show, we visit again with Robin Hanel. World-renowned economist speaks about the role of the IMF, the Structural Adjustment Policies, SAPs, in this economic crisis. He also speaks about the ongoing developments in Iceland and Greece and shares some success stories and strategies for change moving forward. So stay tuned.
Judy Rebick is our guest this morning. We're very privileged to have Judy Rebick, who's a longtime feminist and social justice activist. She lives in Toronto and currently holds the CAW Sam Gidden Chair in Social Justice and Democracy at Ryerson University. Judy is a writer and was the founding publisher of www.rubble.ca. Her latest book is Transforming Power, From the Personal to the Political. During the 1990s, Judy was the co-host of a national TV show on CBC, and in the 1980s, she helped to lead the fight to legalize abortion in Canada, then went on to be elected president of Canada's largest women's group, leading high-profile fights around reproductive rights, employment equity, constitutional reform, and anti-racism. In the last 10 years, her focus has been more on global solidarity and online activism. Thank you so much for being with us, Judy.
My pleasure.
Now, we are going to be celebrating Women's International Day on March the 8th, and many marches will take place throughout Canada, the U.S., and possibly worldwide. What has been the legacy of women? What are the challenges we've overcome, and what are the challenges ahead?
Well, you know, since I was a young woman, there's been a real revolution in the status of women in society, not just in Canada, but around the world. You know, when I was a woman, I was told, you know, women can't be doctors, women can't be lawyers, you're supposed to go to university to find a husband, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, my mother had to quit her job when she got pregnant, couldn't sign a mortgage or a credit card without her husband's consent, and so on. Marital rape was legal until 1982 in Canada, and I could go on and on and on. So in one generation, the status of women has been transformed through the women's movement. I mean, there's no question that it was by ordinary women organizing, starting in the late 60s and continuing till today, to demand a change. I guess to organize to our own liberation, and also to demand changes in laws and in the participation of women in education, in politics, and so on. That having been said, I think there's a serious threat to our rights now, both at a global level and a local level. At a global level, it's the divisions between rich and poor, the divisions between North and South, that risk the status of women in both the North and the South. And I think that more and more, the women's movement is a global one, which is part of the global justice movement. And we can talk about that more if you like. In Canada, we have a government which is systematically going about destroying or trying to destroy many of the gains that the women's movement made. So they have removed gender equality from language in all government documents. Even in the Office of the Status of Women, instead of making the mandate of the office to achieve gender equality, they've made it to increase the participation of women, which is a much more limited goal. They've cut funding to almost every advocacy group in the country, with the exception of Equal Voice and Equal Voices, about electing more women to, in electoral politics. They have closed down Status of Women offices. They have cut the daycare program. Even though that daycare program wasn't what we wanted, nevertheless, it was the beginning of a national daycare program that the Liberals put in place. They cut that. They have welched on pay equity at the federal level, and the impact of it is really quite remarkable. I mean, basically, in the World Economic Forum gender gap ratings, in 2004, Canada was fifth, and now Canada is 47th. So Canada is falling internationally in a number of ways, but particularly in relation to the status of women. And then there's other areas where there seems to be a stubborn resistance to change, which you can't really blame on the government per se, but more on the political system, and that is that we still only have, 20% women in parliament, and not much better at the provincial or local level. So the representation of women in the electoral arena is very poor, and it's very poor also, in any kind of corporate leadership. So where we have tremendous improvement, like the participation of women in universities, for example, are now a majority of universities are equal in terms of graduate degrees, but even still, women are just making, I think it's now 71%, 71 cents to every dollar men are making. So I guess what we say is we've come a long way, and really there's been a transformation of the status of women and the attitudes toward women in our society. But we still have quite a long way to go.
Understanding, though, the sociopolitical and economic structure and seeing the interconnection of the two and how our society is organized is key, because as you point out, many of the changes that we're seeing sound great in paper, equality of voice, well, that sounds great, but if economically we are still excluded from that sphere, what does it really mean? In Latin America, yeah, with the military coup in Honduras, we saw a women's movement rising up who said, yes, we want the president back, and that was one step, that was one minor goal. But the real goal was the redrafting of their constitution to address the inequalities within the system. In your book, you talk about transforming power from the personal to the political. How does this transformation play a role in transforming that system that upholds, this?
Well, I think a good example is Bolivia, where women in Bolivia were much more behind in terms of women's equality than women in Canada. But the new government, it's not a new government, it's been reelected. In Evo Morales' new cabinet is 50% female. And their constitution, their new constitution, sets the goal of 50% of gender equality, minimal gender equality, at every level, in every institution, in every body that the government appoints, or that's elected. So you sort of see what used to call combined and uneven development. But if you have a government that is transforming, that's anti-capitalist and is transforming a country into a more socially equal country, then gender equality has to be at the center of that. And that's what Bolivia understood. And I think that the same is true for everything we do. Like, I think right now what's happening in Latin America, on the Latin American left, and it's not quite there yet on our left, is a sort of bringing together of a transforming of left politics through the influence of ancient indigenous knowledge, environmentalism, and feminism. And this is a real change that we're seeing throughout Latin America and the way the left is starting to see politics. And it's being led, I think, from Bolivia and by indigenous people in general. And I think it's very exciting. Unfortunately, we're just starting to see some of that in North America, less in Canada than in the United States. But I think that a radical equality approach, where we don't accept the domination of any group over another group, nor the domination of the global north over the global south, it leads inevitably to equality for women. And equality for women, of course, has to be central to that. And part of the reason we've got stalled and now moving backwards in terms of women's equality is because where we ran up against barriers was on economic level. So, for example, daycare. We're coming up to the 40th anniversary of the Royal Commission on the Status of Women. And one of their main recommendations was a national child care program. And that is probably the only original demand of the women's movement that we haven't won. And the reason we haven't won it is because it costs so much money. and because it challenged, in a way, the economic status of women in a profound way. And the other place, even though we've gotten some pay equity bills, we still really stalled in terms of women's wages compared to men's wages. So everywhere we run up against, there's two ways we run up against barriers, and one is on the economic front, because we have such an unequal economic system, and during the time that women were making gains, the economic system was becoming more and more unequal. And so the gains that women made is often not available to women in poorer working class. You know, women who are poorer working class have to work 2-3 jobs to make a living, and so whatever benefits the women's movement gained in terms of women's rights are pretty meaningless if you have to work all the time just to feed your kids. And then the other area where we run up is where there's power, the concentration of power, whether that's at in media, in government, or in corporations. And those organizations are still very much built like pyramids with men at the top. Somebody called it a menocracy, you know. Well, and when women get to the top, they get there by fitting in with men, and therefore they don't really change anything.
You make a very salient point, and that is that if women were paid the same wages that men of similar qualifications earn, half of the families now living in poverty would not be poor. But another part of that is that our society would significantly be transformed. I think at the center of our feminist movement has been the hope to create a society that's more egalitarian, that's organized on egalitarian principles.
That's right.
So how do we then...
And, you know, it's no accident that the place where women, where the status of women is highest, is in the Scandinavian countries. The Scandinavian countries are the ones that have developed social democracy in the most advanced form, so that you know, they have real social much stronger social programs than we have. And part of that is they have much more equality for women. And so the relationship between equality for women and a more just, equal economic system is very clear. In Scandinavia.
In Canada, we think of our situation as fortunate. We think we're far better off than many women worldwide. And usually when I point out some of the areas that need improvement, from, say, well, you know, you're lucky you don't live there. You live in a great country. And the argument often becomes, this is better than, so... you know, don't speak about it. But one of the points you've made is the connection between social programs like education, healthcare, childcare programs, and equitable wages for women and men as a foundation, as almost the fabric of a society that's well functioning and productive. In our society, these things seem to be being eroded as we speak. We are the government will be unveiling a budget on March 2nd here in BC, and already there's rumors of significant cuts to health and education. Talk about the impact that this have on us as being able to move forward the not just the rights of women, but the improvements that our society needs as a whole.
The problem with cuts to education, a serious problem, is that what tends to happen, particularly at a post-secondary level, is that what's happened, in fact, because we've already had cuts and increases in tuition, is not only that less privileged students aren't able to go to university, but if they do go, they're saddled with debt, and they have to work. So when I was in university, nobody who I went to university with had to work during the year. Nobody. I didn't know a single person in 4 years of university that had to work at a part-time job because tuition was low, right? And living expenses were lower. I mean, people had summer jobs, but not during the year, whereas at least half of my students are working part-time, and some of them even full-time, so that they can get through school. And on top of that, they're saddled with a huge debt when they leave school, which means that it's much harder to be active in the community. It's much harder to contribute to the community in other ways. And you're much more, forced into taking certain kinds of jobs that are going to pay well and so on. So that's an issue in terms of education, is that you have much more of a class difference. in terms of who gets to go to school. Now, like I say, that hasn't that's what we were afraid of. That hasn't panned out so much because of the fact of people going into debt. But if that stops being possible, the kinds of debts that we're living under now, then we're going to see a class division like we saw in the 40s and 50s. In terms of health care, you know, what happens with health care is whenever there's cuts to health care, women are burdened with the care of relatives. That's just the reality. You know, like, even as much as we fought for 40 years for men to take more of the caring role in the family, and many men are starting to, especially in terms of parenting, overwhelmingly, statistically, women are still in the caring role. And so they're caring for children, they're caring for elders, they're caring for sick family. And while there's minimal support for that, it's very minimal. So there's no care allowances, there's nothing like that, and unlikely to be. And so as soon as you have cutbacks in health care, there's more encouragement for people to stay at home, for people not to use hospitals, and so on and so forth. And the burden of that care falls on women. And now the other issue is pensions, because women are overwhelmingly poor. You know, older women are among the poorest women. You know, if you look at single moms and older women, those are the two poorest groups of women, because most women don't have access to the kind of pensions men have. The only women who have access to good pensions are women who work in the public sector and have been working there for some time. And so if they start cutting back on pensions, or if they don't improve the pension situation, we're going to wind up with a tremendous number of older women in poverty. And that's going to be a serious issue as well. And, you know, it's pretty disgusting, really, that they found all this money to give to Bay Street or to Wall Street to bail them out, but they can't find money for a child care program, or not to mention that $6 billion. It's interesting that the Olympics cost $6 billion, because that's the estimation of what it would cost to have a national child care program. So we can find the $6 billion for the Olympics, we can find the however many trillion for bailouts, but we can't find enough for a child care program or to keep our healthcare system healthy.
And I think in terms of women achieving some equitable status in society, those things are so instrumental in allowing the participation of women. But also,
Well, totally. But the other thing is, you know, the place where women have good-paying jobs is in the public sector. And if, as we suspect, the cutbacks will be in the public sector, although it looks like they're holding off for a year on that federally, but provincially, then it's women who are going to lose their jobs. And so the one place where women are unionized and do have good-paying jobs is the one place that's going to be most vulnerable in the next period of cutbacks.
Well, here in BC, we saw the Gordon Campbell shred contracts for the healthcare workers, and 8,000 women were put out of work. So you see a trend of an attack that's very directed to those who are most vulnerable. And the idea is that if people didn't agree, they would be out on the streets. But as you point out, many of these women are already working two and three jobs to be able to support their
that's
families.
Right. And there's a kind of numbness that sets in, too. You know, it's just like there's such a sense of scarcity that they create that people don't think that there's anything they can do. And, you know, people are fighting to keep their jobs, and then they're fighting to keep their family fed. And so it's there's a kind of feeling of scarcity and inability to change anything that sets in, and that means that people aren't willing to move into struggle. And that's, I think, what we've been seeing over the last number of years. That's why I'm very happy about this Canadians Against Proroguing Parliament movement, because it's the first time that we've seen a real movement, first time in a long time that we've seen a real movement emerge that isn't coming from the usual suspects, you know what I mean? It's kind of coming from people who haven't been active politically before, who are saying we want citizens to be more involved in the political process, and I think that's enormously positive.
Your book talks about this need for us to become more engaged politically. How do we make that transformation when we have been inactive for so long?
I mean, last night I was speaking at the Toronto Public Library, and it was just a little story, and we were talking about the sort of Orwellian language that the Harper government's using in terms of human rights and so on internationally. And at the end of it, you know, there were a few young people there, and they said, oh, we want to really get involved, but we don't know how, right? I think it's like there is a kind of activism emerging, and I think the main thing is to say, do something. Like, I don't really think it matters what you do, but I think just getting engaged, whether it's around a community activity or whether it's around the Olympics or it's around a student activity or whatever it might be, you know, volunteering at a rape crisis center, whatever it might be, just getting engaged in a project that's working for change, to change the society. You know, not everybody wants to go out in a demonstration. There's lots of other things you can do. For example, you know, there's this food movement that's emerged on an urban level of, you know, farm to table and organic food, making organic food accessible to poor people and community gardens and all of that. I think that movement is very important in terms of showing an alternative to the capitalist food distribution system. And there's a lot that's going on at a community level and at a national and international level that people can get involved in. I mean, there knows in Vancouver, I know there's lots of international solidarity groups that are working. And those international solidarity groups, I mean, what I found when I was, because I've been really involved in that in the last number of years, is that you really learn a lot, too. Like, we can learn so much from what's going on in Latin America in particular, I think, but also what's happening in other parts of the world. And that connection, which we have now, which we never really had in the same way before, means that our struggles can be greatly magnified because of the international connection. So I think there's lots and lots of things people can do, but the main thing is to not fall prey to cynicism. I think one of the things that those of us that are privileged, that don't have to, you know, worry about where our next meal is coming from, it's very easy for us to fall into cynicism, you know, and just crap on everything and not do anything. And I think cynicism is a privilege of the well-to-do. Not, I don't mean rich. I mean people who are in a safe, secure environment. Otherwise, you got to fight to change things because your life depends on it, right? The life of your children depends on it. So I think it's really important for people to sort of shake off a stupor or cynicism or a feeling that doesn't matter what you do, because it does matter. One of the strengths that I have is I've seen the changes in my lifetime in terms of women. That's huge. It's like even young women can't even, you know, when I wrote my book, 10,000 Roses, young women were reading, I say, I can't believe this happened. Your mother couldn't sign a credit card without her husband signing? Like, nobody could believe that, right? Because things have changed so much. Or that, you know, when I was 20 years old, if I sat in a restaurant by myself, they'd all think I was a prostitute, you know? So these kinds of things changed. I saw them change, and they changed because ordinary people organized. You know, it's important for people to get active in whatever way is meaningful to them.
That's so beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. And how can people access your book?
Well, it's available really pretty well everywhere. I mean, you can find it online. You know, I hate to say the corporate Amazon, .ca has it. Octopus Books has it online. And then it should be in all the local bookstores as well still. Because it just came out a year ago, so it still should be available in local bookstores.
Thank you again for
being with us. And if it isn't, then tell them to order it.
Very good. Thank you again for being with us.
My pleasure.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
When I say the hungry should have food, I speak for many. When I say no one should have seven homes, while some don't have any. Though I may find myself stranded in some strange place with naught but a vapid stare, I remember the world and I know we are everywhere. I say the time for the rich, it will come. Let me count the ways, victories or hints of the future. Havana, Caracas, Chiapas, Buenos Aires. How many people are wanting and waiting and fighting for their share? They hide in their ivory towers, but God, we are everywhere. Religions and prisons and races, borders and nations, FBI agents and congressmen, and corporate radio stations. They try to keep us apart, but we find each other, and the rulers are always aware that they're a tiny minority, and we are everywhere. With every bomb that they drop, every home they destroy, every land they invade, comes a new generation from under the rubble saying, we are not afraid. They will pretend we are few, but with each child that a billion mothers bear, comes the next demonstration that we are everywhere. We are everywhere. We are everywhere.
You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com.